When your team's curious and ready to grow, they do their best work, and that changes everything. At CBT Nuggets, we've spent over 25 years making IT training engaging, hands-on, and fun. Expert-led courses, virtual labs, real-world skills your team can use right now. From networking to cloud to cybersecurity, we build skills and confidence that drive results. Believe in your team. Give them the tools to thrive at cbtnuggets.com/solutions.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is best-selling author, associate editor of the Washington Post, David Marinus, whose new book, Path Lit by Lightning, a biography of America's greatest athlete, Jim Thorpe, and also the sad saga of Native Americans reaching into the 20th century. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, and don't forget to tell us where you're from. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Miracle Brand and Magic Spoon, in the show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors. It helps make this podcast happen. So please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast. James Carville, rarely is there a political tsunami outside of November. There was one this past Tuesday in Kansas, which overwhelmingly voted to retain state law protecting a woman's right to choose an abortion. You were the first person outside of that state to highlight this, and note the deck was stacked by the conservatives. Hold it during a primary when more Republicans voted, misrepresenting the language and intent. It didn't matter. In the first test after the Republican Supreme Court overturned Roe, the voters in this deep red state turned out in massive numbers. James, this is what just dazzles me. There were 180,000 more Kansans who voted on this abortion referendum than voted in the Democratic and Republican gubernatorial primaries combined. It's a message that should scare many anti-abortion Republicans around the country. And just a final word, and you are the expert on this, having been there so early. You know, I think this can clearly help Democrats in the fall. Senate candidates promising to vote for a federal law codifying abortion rights, using viability as a standard, not unlimited, while most of their opponents would vote for a national ban. And governors in big states like Michigan and Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Arizona, can draw a contrast by vowing to veto any legislation that bans abortion. But this is a big but. This is a winning supplemental issue. It'd be a big mistake to make it the main focus over economy, jobs, and inflation. But it really matters.
Well, I mean, first of all, I'm very happy to report to our listeners that this show was on this before anybody else, stayed on it longer than anybody else, understood the consequences of it more than anybody else. You know, I told somebody a blind squirrel can find an acorn every now and then. We found a really big acorn. And the chicanery and the duplicity and the lying and the trickery is much worse, and it's worth going through. They put this on a primary ballot, assuming that in Kansas, primaries have low turnouts, most of the primaries are Republican, and it would favor them. The second thing they did is they wrote confusing propaganda messaging on the wording of the ballot proposal. Anybody should just go look at it. The third thing is understand that the Diocese of Kansas City put $4 million in here. If you look up the Diocese of Kansas City in Wikipedia, I think at least in 2019, they had 206 active investigations of sex crimes, all right? $4 million and it was trickery. On election day, they were sending out tweets saying, if you want to protect abortion, vote yes. I mean, it is outrageous. And they tried every cheating thing they could do, and they just didn't get beat, okay? Understand that. They got beat by 18 points, which is, elections like that don't happen. And it's people are sick of this crap. They're sick of the lying. They're sick of these right-wing preachers. They're sick of these clueless Catholic bishops who are tolerant of pedophilia, to say the least. And I think that just was a backlash. And I got to tell you, it was gratifying. I love being on the ground there. I was pretty optimistic. I said I'd be more surprised if we lost by five than we won by five. I didn't see this coming. And the turnout was just astonishing. And this was an earthquake in the middle of the country. Let me tell you, it really significant. And you're right. I rarely sent out tweets. I sent out one is you don't want to be, you know, a one-trick pony here. This is part of a larger thing, and we shouldn't just rely on this issue carrying us.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, but it can help. And right. it is a legitimate issue in Senate and gubernatorial campaigns. I mean, there will
legitimate.
If the Republicans take control of the Senate and the House, they will try to pass a bill outlawing abortion. They can't do it till they get someone in the White House. And Democrats, I mean, now that the Supreme Court has ended Roe, you can pass a simple piece of legislation codifying Roe as national policy.
Don't forget guns, okay? The Georgia legislature and the governor signed a piece of legislation. Basically, you can take a gun anywhere you want in Georgia. There's this huge concert they've been having for quite a while in downtown Atlanta, over 100,000 people, and the promoters called it off because they couldn't accept the liability with these gun laws. And, you know, people say, well, young people are not motivated to vote. You know, well, goddammit, you like going to concerts? Because they're going to be calling them off left and right. This is not the first time that this is going to happen. These permissive gun laws, which, we I point out endlessly, we had an assault weapons ban in this country from 1994 to 2004. Thank you, President Clinton and Senator Joe Biden. And we did everything, right? And this is idiotic, and it's going to cost people, and people do not like it. By the way, Beto O'Rourke is going to do better than people think. One thing I've noticed is people put somebody in a time capsule, and this is done a lot. The press does this a lot. And they don't account for a human being growing. That guy's grown as a human being and a candidate, I can tell you.
Well, and I have to think that abortion's going to help him in Texas, too. Kansas was Trump plus 15. States like Texas and Florida and Iowa,
Florida.
Trump won clearly, but I want to tell you, they weren't winning by 15, and it's going to make a difference on the margins.
By the way, DeSantis doesn't want to talk about abortion, but he's not, it's with Joe Lewis, you can run, but you can't hide. And this puts him front and center. And Florida is much more of a pro-choice state than Kansas.
Well, let's talk about some of those other big primaries, because Tuesday was a huge day, mainly Republicans in four other states. And the Trump effect is mixed. He'll claim credit for Republican Tudor Dixon winning in Michigan. Hell, he embraced her 3 days before the primary when they knew she was going to win. And then in one of the most cowardly acts I've ever seen in Missouri, it was a Senate contest between the Attorney General Eric Schmidt and Eric Greitens, the former disgraced governor. So what did Trump do? He endorsed Eric. So guess what? He's claiming credit now. Sure, Donald. But he did score major wins in Arizona, defeating establishment candidates, apparently for governor, certainly for senator, and secretary of states, with all candidates who peddled the big lie that the 2020 election was stolen. He also backed a congressional candidate in Michigan, with help from Democrats, who think he'll be easier to beat, who defeated one of the 10 Republican representatives who voted to impeach Trump. To Washington State, pro-impeachment Republicans survived this round. But if, as expected, Liz Cheney unfortunately loses next week, 7 of the 10 Republicans who voted their conscience on impeachment, James, will be driven out of the party. The orange criminal has been weakened, no question about that. But with all these election deniers winning, he still is the dominant force and still is the Trump Republican Party.
Well, it's all this Michigan seat. So you had this elite hissy fit about the DCCC running ads to promote these goofy pro-Trump people. You know, I had no problem with it. I actually wholeheartedly approve of it. And at, I think it was Michigan 10th District out in western Michigan, they promoted this goofy guy, and he won by a couple points. It made the difference.
I think it's
if they
three,
win
yeah.
that seat, now, you know, it's still pretty, you know, let's see what happens. But I wish all of these, you know, do-gooders people would, you know, understand that politics is a tough combat sport. And I just, these people have always irritated me, and they irritate me today. They have this smugness about them. You know, we're principled and people in politics are not. Okay, fuck you. That's what I think.
Well, a couple, you know, I think, again, as we've talked about, and I've written about a lot this year, it's candidates against conditions. The conditions aren't great right now for Democrats. Maybe they'll get better. But the candidate contrast is striking. Let me just point out, too. In Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer, the incumbent, is running against this woman, Tudor Dixon, who was a television conservative commentator, did a documentary on how bad Hillary Clinton was and all that. Tudor Dixon, in the state of Michigan, running for governor, is anti-abortion with no exceptions for rape, incest, or life of the mother. Now, there's a 1931 Michigan law, James, that would take effect right now unless Gretchen Whitmer and the legislature stop that. And if Tudor Dixon is elected governor, that's what you'll have. If Kansas is voting this way, you know where Michigan is. And the other one is in Arizona. Blake Masters, who won the Senate primary to face Mark Kelly. Blake Masters wants to privatize Social Security. He wants to outlaw abortion. He wants to impeach Joe Biden for his border policies. And some time ago, you're going to think I'm making this up. You're going to accuse me of fabricating. He said it was a mistake for the United States to enter World War II. Now, I can't believe that a state that has elected Mo Udall, Bruce Babbitt, John McCain, Jeff Flake, and even Barry Goldwater is going to go for this whack job.
Yeah, I completely agree. And something tells me Mark Kelly is going to raise a lot of money. Don't know that, but I think he'll raise much more than he needs. And, you know, the tragedy of all of this is you're looking at the mainstream of the Republican Party. I'm sorry. You know, the myth that there's a Jeff Flake Republican Party is just that, a myth, all right? And we just have to get over it. And people have to get over the fact that the only hope for the United States, the only one, is to elect Democrats. I'm sorry. You know, I realize the party screwed up. I realize we got some, you know, kind of people who are goofy, silly, from time to time proposed, but I think are silly proposals. But that's the only hope you have. You just give up on them. There's no chance. And the problem is, you know, as Lester Baddock said, the problem with the jails in Georgia is the quality of the inmate. The Republican Party has a massive problem. Is the most of the people that vote in their primaries are low-quality human beings, and you can't get around that. It's it's that Republican voter that's doing this, and it's not every Republican, but it's a majority of Republicans, and let's understand that. And as distasteful as some of these Democrats can be, that's the only hope the United States has.
You know, in the past, when you would argue over taxes or national security or the level of government spending, you know, you and I might have one view and it might be different. But there was a legitimate debate. I mean, you could at least argue it, you know, whatever you thought the merits were. When you have hundreds of Republican candidates for high office, governor, senator, secretary of state, running on denying that the 2020 election was legitimate, that is a 100% certifiable lie. I mean, that's just and it does great damage to the Republic. It really does. And they're dangerous. And you're right. They have to be defeated.
But understand it. You know, at the times the arguments were being made, you suspected they were wrong, but you didn't know. So when they said, well, if you cut taxes on wealthy people, there'll be a trickle down effect. Everything will blossom. That has turned out to be demonstratively not true. Okay, they might have thought it was going to work, but in the year 2022, we know more than we did in 1982. And cutting taxes on rich people has one effect. It makes rich people richer, and that's it.
Yeah, now, but James, let me interrupt because, I'm sorry. That's still, I agree with you, but that's still a debate. The idea that the election was fraudulent, idea that it was stolen, that is a much more serious, a much deeper lie. That profoundly affects our whole system of government.
There's not a serious person that would say that cutting taxes for rich people is similar to the economy. I'm sorry.
I disagree with them, but there are people who say that. It is totally different than saying that the election was fraudulent. That goes to the kind of cornerstone of what a democratic system is all about. I think it's a mistake to conflate the two.
I'm just making a point. I'm saying that we now have a mountain of evidence that this shit doesn't work. We didn't know for sure if things like Head Start or nutritional assistance or some of that stuff, we thought it was a good idea, but we didn't know. We now know that works. We now know that. And it does not promote people not working and all those stuff to say. We have a body of evidence. We grow in knowledge over 40 years.
James, I'm not making my point. There's not only a mountain of evidence, there's a universe of evidence that came in right away that the election was legitimate. That is a issue that really goes to the heart. If you don't believe in honest elections in this country, it doesn't matter what your views are on other things. It really doesn't.
Right. Well, I agree that's idiotic and everything else, but I don't necessarily, glorify their past. I thought I will accept the fact that maybe they thought what they was doing would work. We now know it doesn't work. And yet, legitimate Republicans, try to say that. But at any rate, most of the tenants that they had, might have been good people, they might have thought it was going to work, have been disproved time and time and time again. They started this stuff about, well, if you raise the minimum wage, you're going to hurt jobs. We now know that's not true. But it's not even argument that people even make in economic circles anymore. I agree with you. It's different between being for bullshit, demonstrably provable policies, and claiming that an election was stolen. I didn't mean one is a sort of political, calculation that you just choose to avoid evidence. The other is criminality, and I'm not comparing the people on January 6th to the Reaganomics people, but one of the criminals, one is just flat out wrong, and there's a difference between the two.
There is. All right, we agree on that. Okay. Hey, James, whether it's politics, war, family, or sports, David Marinus writes great books. I have said he and Evan Osnos are our David Halberstams. He's just incredible. David, your latest, Jim Thorpe, may be the best.
Oh.
You write not only about the greatest athlete, but the sad saga of our treatment of Native Americans. Let's start with the athlete. Excelled in track, running and throwing, played professional football, professional baseball, even tried a little basketball. We've never seen an athlete quite like this, have we?
Well, no athlete in the modern times has done everything that Jim Thorpe did. I think there might be some athletes who could have done it, like Bo Jackson, perhaps. Thorpe was unique. In all of those ways. No one has ever won gold medals, been the best football player in America, All-American in college, and the greatest pro during the early years, and played Major League Baseball. Not even Michael Jordan could do that. Thorpe wasn't as good at baseball as he was at football and track, but he was a major leaguer, and in one year with the Boston Braves, he hit .327. So, there you go.
We'll sign him for the Washington Nationals right now. David, tell us about the Carlisle Indian School. That's where he made his mark. It was one of the great powerhouses in the early part of the 20th century. Tell us about the school.
Well, the purpose of the Carlisle Indian Industrial School, its motto was, kill the Indian, save the man. Its purpose was to acculturate, to assimilate American Indians and make them as white as possible. It was, and ironically, an effort done by progressives thinking they were doing well in preventing the Indians from suffering from genocide. But in fact, they were taking away their culture, their religion, their hair even. They'd cut their hair, their language, everything about them to try to make them white. It had several sort of contradictory effects. One was that it had a great football team led by the legendary Pop Warner, who really made his name at Carlisle with Jim Thorpe. They played all of the best teams on the East Coast, Harvard, Yale, Army, Syracuse, and beat them all, Penn, beat them all during that period when East Coast dominated in football. But the school had as many minuses as it did pluses. It took Indians away from their homelands. The first Indians who went there in 1879 when it was formed were Lakota Sioux, and they thought they were going east to die to show their bravery. And sadly, over the years, many young Native Americans did die at that school. To walk the cemetery there, which is now the Army War College, still has the Indian cemetery there, and to walk that is a haunting experience, seeing all of those young American Indians who died while they were at school there.
Well, we'll come back to the treatment of the Indians. Let me, a couple more things about Thorpe the athlete. 1912 was the year of Jim Thorpe. The Stockholm Olympics, and then for him and his teammates, a special football game against West Point.
You know, I think that that year might have been the most luminescent year of any athlete in sports history, starting with those incredible performances in Stockholm, where he won both the decathlon and the pentathlon, running away with both of those great events. And then he came back from that and was basically a global figure by that time, but he went back to Carlisle for his final season playing football and had a great All-American season. You know, the statistics in that era are incredibly iffy, but he seems like he ran for at least 2,000 yards. And the greatest game he ever played was against West Point on November 9th, 1912. Mikey Stadium didn't exist then. The game was played on the plane. And it was, think about it, it was American Indians against basically the U.S. Army, finally on a level playing field. And the Indians knew what they were up against that day and what it meant symbolically. And Jim Thorpe had his greatest game ever in a 27-6 win, where he outplayed and knocked out of the game a linebacker for West Point named Dwight David Eisenhower.
And another West Pointer, Omar Bradley, watched that game from the bench.
On the bench,
wow.
Exactly.
Talk about history. I'm going to turn it over to James in just a minute. But then after that, the rains came. They stripped him of his medals because he played minor league baseball. Two of the villains in that story that you write about were Avery Brundage, yep, the longtime, I think, awful head of the Olympics, who refused to consider the medals injustice, and actually Pop Warner, his superb football coach, but when it mattered, didn't show much character.
Now, Pop Warner was an innovative, inventive, brilliant football coach. You know, after he left Carlisle, he led Pitt to some undefeated seasons and then went on to Stanford. And of course, people know him today because youth football is basically named after Pop Warner. When I studied what he did with Jim Thorpe, he was cowardly. He knew exactly what Thorpe was doing. I document that in the book. For years, he had sent his athletes to play minor league baseball in the Bush Leagues. Thorpe was recruited by one of Pop Warner's best buddies up in Pennsylvania to play in the Eastern Carolina League. Now, hundreds of young college athletes were playing minor league baseball during the summers during that era, but they were all doing it under aliases. You know, Dwight Eisenhower, who I already mentioned, played in the Kansas State League under the name Wilson. There were so many aliases in the Eastern Carolina League that they called it the Pocahontas League because everybody was named John Smith. Jim Thorpe played under his own name. And when it was finally revealed, I mean, he played under his own name, so it was in the box scores in North Carolina every day for 2 years. But 1913, shortly after he won the gold medals, another East Coast paper in Worcester, Massachusetts, wrote the story interviewing one of his coaches down in Carolina. And then the big story broke, and Pop Warner pretended that he didn't know anything about it, and he basically threw Jim under the bus from that point on. Avery Brundage, it's stunning to me. I didn't really think about it, but, you know, you think about Brundage as this fat cat, cigar-smoking, rich hotelier. He was a decathlete himself. He competed in those 1912 Olympics on the team with Jim Thorpe, and he was terrible. He was so bad that he quit before the final events. You know, this arbiter of amateurism who constantly was talking about how it was important just to compete and not nationality or how you did. He quit because he was doing so poorly. Anyway, from then on, as he rose through the ranks, first to become the head of the American Olympic Committee, the U.S. Olympic Committee, the International Olympic Committee, decade after decade, he refused to allow Jim his medals back while everybody else was pushing for them. And he went to his grave still denying Thorpe his justice.
Well, you know, against Jim Thorpe and for the Nazis in 1936.
Exactly.
What a legacy. James Carville.
How did he get his medals back, David?
That's a good question, because in 1983, when the Olympics were coming to Los Angeles the next year, finally enough pressure had been put on Juan Antonio Samaranch, the IOC president, that they did a celebration in L.A., where they gave Jim Thorpe's 7 children copies of those medals. That's all they did. They didn't change the record books. He still was considered, he wasn't in the record books. The people who finished in second place in Stockholm in those events were still considered the winners. And it wasn't until this last month that finally the IOC decided that enough was enough, and they put Thorpe back in the record books. The medals are, who knows where those are, but he's got the records that matter the most for him. He is the Olympic champion again. It took 80 years.
So let's go back to November 9th, 1912. And this was a football game, but it was very much a cultural event. I mean, I think the Indians and the Native Americans were a little pissed off at the French and Indian wars. I mean, the Indian wars the U.S. conducted on them. And there were probably some people still on the faculty at West Point that participated in those wars. I mean, was there a real sense we're going to get these sons of bitches for what they did to us?
Oh, totally. Yes. And Pop Warner, the coach, played up that fact, you know, that this was finally the time to get back at the long knives, as the cavalry was called. You're absolutely right. I mean, you know, this event, the game took place only a mile from the grave of George Armstrong Custer, you know. And the Carlisle Indian School was founded only 3 years after the Battle of the Little Bighorn. So all of this history was playing out. And, you know, there's a great Native American novelist and playwright named M. Scott Momaday. And I quote him in the book saying, you know, there was something in the air that cold November day, something made of omens and prophecies. Some old imbalance was being set right. And that's really, you know, I mean, football games are football games, but this one was more than that.
It was well covered nationally. I mean,
totally.
My dad used to talk about it all the time. He was just, you know, Jim Thorpe's greatest athlete ever lived.
Yeah, Grantland Rice.
When I grew up, there wasn't any question.
Grantland Rice loved Jim Thorpe, he wrote about him whenever he could from then on for decades. But, I mean, it's hard to think about today, but East Coast football was the thing then in college sports.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
LSU was good, but really the East Coast is where all the sports writers were, and that got all the attention. So every sports writer in New York, at a time when there were 20-some newspapers in New York, went up to West Point for that game, and it was incredibly well covered.
Before I turn it over, just as a historical thing, a lot of Union heroes, Phil Sheridan, you know, even my guy, William Tecumseh Sherman, LSU's first president, they didn't distinguish themselves in the Indian Wars or in the Civil War.
Well, the U.S. government was pretty awful. I mean, it was the U.S. policy, you know, to basically manifest destiny. The Indians were in the way, get rid of them by whatever means necessary. So, you know, doing phony treaties, moving them across the Mississippi, and then killing them once there, and then taking away their land and sending them away from their homelands. So, Sheridan, Sherman, even O.O. Howard, for whom Howard University is named, was an army general who chased Chief Joseph and the Nez Perce all the way across the Northwest. So there's this irony that many of these great generals who fought to free the slaves, you know, in the Civil War, were progressive on African-American issues, were also Indian killers. It's just part of the contradictions of American history.
Well, no one brings them to light better than you, Albert.
David, Jim Thorpe is not an especially large man. And one of the great descriptions that you cite in the book is of the famed poet Marianne Moore, who taught at Carlisle, who said he had an ease in his gait, equilibrium without structure. He was the epitome of concentration, wary with an effect of plenty and reserve. Wow.
You know, a great athlete when you see them, usually. And there's something that's just electric about their presence. And Jim Thorpe had that. I think Marianne Moore described it as well as anyone could, but sometimes you just have to see it. And, you know, Thorpe was one of those athletes that was powerful, beautiful, electric. Great athletes never look like they're working that hard until they are, you know, whether it's Lionel Messi on the soccer field or, you know, anybody. I mean, they all have this incredible storage of energy that they explode with when need be. And that's the way Jim Thorpe was.
Well, boy, you know, even looking at his pictures in your book, you get that sense. It's incredible. You know, as an American Indian, he faced slights throughout his entire adult life, before Carlisle, doing Carlisle, and a lot afterwards.
Yeah.
But he championed their cause. He tried to get Hollywood, you write, to have Indians play Indians in movies. He failed, even in the movie about his life. But he never ran away from his heritage, did he?
He did not. He was, you know, he wasn't the most political figure I've written about, even among athletes, compared to, for instance, Roberto Clemente. But on the issues of Native American rights, he was very strong throughout his life. And you're right, there was a period in the 1930s, especially, when he was living near Los Angeles, and he was basically the leader of about 200 to 300 Native Americans who were extras on movie sets. And they were pushing hard to persuade the studios to hire actual Indians instead of fake Indians with grease paint, white guys or whatever, to play Indians. So he was the leader of that movement during that entire period. And it reflected his pride in who he was.
David, he died in a trailer park, destitute, drinking cheap wine, you write. Yet you don't see his life overall as a tragic one.
Well, it certainly had a lot of tragedy to it. But no, I mean, you know, I kept, you know, as I was researching the book, I kept rooting for something better to happen for him as he, you know, as he lived out those final 30 years. And then I came to realize that it was perseverance, that he showed incredible perseverance. Just keep going, keep trying to find another job, keep hoping for that break. And, you know, as you guys know, and Carville sort of lived off this, you know, perseverance is a wonderful attribute for a politician or for anybody in life.
Yeah. So David, I got to tell you, it's one of my five greatest political stories of all time, and you were involved in it.
Okay.
So it was a Saturday in September of 92, and I'm at the Capitol Bar in Little Rock drinking with Hunter Thompson and P.J. O'Rourke or something, And George calls and says, holy shit. He said, David Marinus has a story. The Republicans put out something that Clinton had raised taxes 124 times. It was total bullshit. That it raised a fee at a state park. They'd call it a tax increase. And so you called Betsy Wright, and she said, well, it actually was 127, not 124. you ruined my Saturday night.
I'm sorry, James, but I think some other things ruined more of your Saturday nights than that.
But it's just, it's name-dropping at its best. It has the benefit, unlike a lot of Tories, still, it's 100% true. It's not at all exaggerated.
No, it is true.
Yep. You had a good sense to call Betsy and not me.
Oh, totally. That's what you got to do.
Who's going to spill the beans? Well, I mean, you've had a remarkable career in journalism and as a biographer and everything else, and you know, all of our listeners would be well to read this book and the other ones that you've written. I mean, the one on Bill Clinton, the one on Obama, Vince Lombardi. I mean, you name it. I mean, you have a real range, and it was just a delight to be able to interview you on this show.
Well, you sure are, and the wonderfully touching one you wrote about your family, too, David. Let me ask you a question that just puzzles me. There is a small town in the Poconos named Jim Thorpe. It's one of the very few towns in America with a surname and a last name. And I guess that may help keep the legacy alive. Yet some of his relatives wanted his bones to return to his native Oklahoma, his tribal ancestral home. Which would have been better? Or which is better?
Well, let me start by saying I have nothing against the people of Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania. They didn't do anything wrong. It was Jim Thorpe's third wife who basically sold his bones to some place that would build a mausoleum to him, and she persuaded them to change their name to Jim Thorpe from Mauch Chunk in East Mauch Chunk, Pennsylvania, to Jim Thorpe. So they did it, and, you know, they built the mausoleum. His bones are there. People go there. It's not the biggest tourist attraction in the world. But, you know, I believe that just like the young people who died at Carlisle and are buried in the cemetery there, finally they're being repatriated to their homelands, you know, to the Ojibwa in Wisconsin and the Lakota Sioux in South Dakota and elsewhere. And I think Jim Thorpe belongs with the Sac and Fox in Oklahoma. That's where he was from. That's who he is. And he never stepped in Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania in his life until he was... You know,
well, I'll say this. I don't know if it was egregious or not, but it's not even in comparison of Trump burying his first wife to get a tax break on his golf course.
It's a stretch, James, but there's something there that's a little bit off about both of them.
Right.
More so than Trump.
I think you're probably right, but I want to second what James said for all of our listeners out there. You want to get right away, Path Lit by Lightning. I mean, the Jim Thorpe book, it is an incredible read. There are parts that are really sad. David, you know, you talked about you're doing your research. I kept pulling, you know, I'd get to page, you know, 344 and say, all right, it's going to get better now. It's going to get better now. But it is an incredible book. And again, it's Path Lit by Lightning by the great David Marinus. Please, everybody get it. And David, thank you so much.
Yeah, you bet. Not 124, 127.
All right.
All right, man. All right.
Thank you.
Okay, now for our questions, which we love every week. Gosh, we got a great group of people out there sending in questions. James, we got a number of questions who want to turn to the great Machiavelli of American politics, James Carville. So Linda in Holden, Mass. Asks, does making campaign phone calls do any good? She's obviously involved in a campaign. They usually seem to annoy people, and they're miserable. So does it make more sense just to donate money, which I do as well? And by the way, you know, what do you think of the state party in places like Pennsylvania? But take the first.
Yes. I mean, I think a direct contribution to a campaign, I always tell our listeners that's the best thing you can do is give it direct to the campaign. It, and a lot of it depends on the list that you get. You know, I mean, are you making calls to get, you know, potential Democrats out to vote? Are you calling swing voters, et cetera, et cetera? They're doing phone calls. The most important thing is the list of voters you get. But there's also, you might annoy some people, but there's some people that are just lonely. I mean, if you can see it when you go to a supermarket or you go to a coffee shop, and they just have a chance to converse, and you could get some voters to come out and vote that maybe wouldn't or forgot about the election. So, but I think it's a noble undertaking and can be of some value.
I guess, boy, I stay home most days, and I hate all those telephone calls. But
you have a lot of people that call you. There's a lot of lonely people in this world.
Yeah, that's
true. Particularly people that don't vote that much. I mean, you know, with people that listen to the show are engaged, and after the show you get 5 text messages, and you return 3 calls. Most people's lives are not like that. And I think the phone calls can be effective, particularly in older. Less affluent Americans.
Yeah. Well, Kim in Ashburn, Virginia, says she votes in every election, a solid Democrat. But come on, the Democrats play too nice, she says. If charges aren't brought against Trump, I have to question my knocking doors, serving as election officer, or voting anymore. Aside from being a good citizen or trying to save democracy with my one little vote, what's the point? Kim, you're right. There's a lot of stories written about the political repercussions if Merrick Garland, or I suppose the prosecutor down in Atlanta, indicts a former president. Well, let me tell you, there are huge consequences if they don't indict a former president. The consequences, certainly for people like you, will make you certainly less eager to stay involved, as you apparently are in politics. And for those people who talk about the rule of law, you don't want to have to put an asterisk. It's the rule of law for everybody except an ex-president.
Yeah, I'm very sympathetic to the way you feel. And, it's always a discussion. Well, if you indict Trump, are you just going to stoke his thing up, or what are you doing? If you think he's a criminal, bring him to justice. All right, and I got to give to January 6th. A lot of people skeptical about this committee. I take a little credit. I was a little less skeptical and more optimistic than a lot of people. But, I think they've done a good job of bringing heat. And, Merrick Garland's a busy man. He's a very measured person. But somebody pointed, he prosecuted the Oklahoma City bomber, the Unabomber, the Olympic bomber. All right, and this guy, we tend to get down on him. But he might be, he might be very quiet, and he might be very deadly here. And I think that he is starting to realize, and they're starting to call people, that you just can't let anybody in the country, much less the president, go on a crime spree, because that's all Trump was on, was a crime spree. And the shit in Atlanta is serious. It's a heartbeat.
Dan in Concord, New Hampshire, I think maybe trying to tweak you a little bit here. He says, if Democrats were in the majority in a state with a crucial ballot question, would you favor scheduling the vote for a date inconvenient to the other party, as Republicans did in Kansas?
I can't think of a solid example, but I probably would, but I would be a little trepidatious, because if you do that, what happened in Kansas actually pissed people off. You got to be careful, because it's the law of unintended consequences. I don't think it was... It was some dubious legality to have a ballot measure on a primary ballot. They did something to cover it up. But people, a lot of times Democrats will schedule a casino referendum on the day of an election under the correct theory that the casino people spend a lot of money on GOTV. And a lot of minorities and Democrats are targeted for to get out the vote to go vote on a casino referendum. That's not unheard of, and I don't so much think is what they did was unethical, but it backfired, because when you try that, it people see it and it irritates the hell out of them, and I think that was a big part of what happened in Kansas. If you put this convoluted propaganda message that's on the ballot, it really irritates the hell out of people, because they can see through it. So answer is, I would do it if I thought it worked, but I'm very, very cautious, because when people catch on to what you're trying to do, it irritates them.
Yeah, yeah, no, I agree. John in Spring, Texas, asked, was Pelosi going to Taiwan a bad idea? John, virtually the entire foreign policy establishment, most editorial writers, most foreign policy columnists say, yes, it was a bad idea. I disagree. I think she showed, if an American speaker can't go to another country because they are threatened by whether it's China, Russia, or any place else, I just think that's unacceptable. I think our relations with China, far more than Russia, are the most important geopolitical question in the next 20 or 25 years. I'm sure this upsets the Chinese. I'm sure they'll take some action. But if she had backed away from that trip, I think the consequences would have been greater. And once again, I think Nancy Pelosi showed her determination, her grit, and her courage.
Well, of course, I worship Nancy Pelosi. And the thing I like about her most is she's a politician. I like that. Guess, if you just had to guess off the top of your head, what congressional district in the United States has the most people with relatives in Taiwan? I'll give you a hint. San Francisco. All right? And her going there is, you know, it's different, but, you know, a lot of Jewish congressmen or congressmen with a lot of Jews in the district go to Israel. It's not uncommon for Irish politicians to go to Ireland, you know, Italian politicians to go to Italy. She was doing constituent service, too. Don't forget that there was a political motivation here. And I kind of like that. That's part of her job.
Well, and another disagreement.
The foreign policy establishment doesn't acknowledge that politics exists.
Yeah, I don't think that had a thing to do with her trip. She was going to question whether she wins by 84% or 82%. And she has been, you know, she was in Tiananmen in 1990. Protesting what the Chinese had done there. She has a long record on this. I'm not surprised that she went, and I think on balance it's good that she did go.
She was probably informed by many of her, you know, constituents as to the problem, but, you know, every politician runs scared.
Well, maybe. Cody in Nashville, Tennessee, wants to know, James, could Andrew Yang's Forward Party be exploited to make sure never Trump Republicans go third party instead of going red again?
That's the stupidest idea you can imagine. And it's all this moral vanity. And what are you going to do? You're going to do what Ralph Nader did, all right? You're going to elect George W. Bush. You're going to do what Jill Stein did. You're going to elect Donald Trump, okay? And so what they're going to do to try to raise money and make people feel superior is they will peel off people who would never, who can't stand Republicans, but they like Republican policies like low taxes on rich people or pollution, all right? And this is just Andrew Yang and Christy Todd Whitman and David Jolly just parading in front of the country, you know, how moral and ethical we are. It's a terrible idea. Anybody gets involved in it is a fool.
Agree. Mike in San Diego, California, says about Build Back Better, it looks like a much reduced bill by Joe Manchin may get passed. But would it have been wiser to have broken these down into smaller bills with specific goals and smaller price tags, names like Americans Would Understand, lower prescription drug prices? You know, Mike, that was a debate back then. That's a lot harder to do than you think. You have to go through all kinds of procedural hurdles. Passing legislation is never easy. I haven't been a critic of Chuck Schumer, but I had my doubts. I thought he was no Nancy Pelosi. I give him great credit on this. He showed tremendous patience. He dealt with Senator Manchin, I think, privately, but he dealt with him well. Other senators helped, too. And I think they're going to pass this bill. It's a good bill. It will help a number of people. Should help Democrats a little bit in the fall. And it drove Mitch McConnell crazy. Those are all very worthy goals.
Well, I always defer to you on the legislative process because, A, I don't know very much about it, and B, you know a lot about it. You've covered it for the last gazillion years. My favorite is Susan Collins, who the media keeps falling for every time. saying, well, I can't, because Manchin made a deal with Chuck Schumer, I can't vote for marriage equality. What the hell are you talking about, woman? What does one have to do with the other? And people keep taking her seriously. She's not a serious person. She's goofy, all right? I mean, so you really made me mad because you made a deal. It's absurd. That's why people, it's a large part of why people hate Washington.
That reminds me with the great basketball story that Jerry Tarkanian said that the NCAA is so mad at Kentucky that they're going to put Cleveland State on probation.
Yeah,
it's the same thing.
The other thing is they've really got it. It was good to see. I give John Stewart a lot of credit on this. It was good to see the cookie jar slam on their hand with this.
Oh, they sure did. John Ted Stewart Cruz. And John Tester.
And they got to keep that fist bump of Ted Cruz and Steve Daines, and they got to run that and loop that and just run it constantly.
Yep. James, we got two questions, one from I'm going to combine them for the final question. John in Sonoma, and then Jerome in Old Bridge. John says, pretend that Trump doesn't get the nomination. Is DeSantis even more of a threat to democracy? And Jerome wants to say, you know, should Democrats do something to try to get the Trump people involved to hurt DeSantis because he could be a bigger threat? Your take on DeSantis v. Trump.
Yeah, he is definitely smarter than Trump. And he's just as, you know, and he's smarter and he's ideologically, like, deeper. He's a strange guy, but, you know, if I were DeSantis, I wouldn't be so much worried about Democrats as I would be worried about Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley and Tom Cotton and people like that. They're going to knock his ass off, and they don't play by the same rules that we do. And if I were, you know, uneasy as the throne, okay, on the head. If I were him, it'd be uneasy, but he's a lot smarter than Trump. I'm just not sure. I'm just one of these people that not sure we're going to get beat in Florida. If Nikki Freed gets the nomination and she and Val Demings, and DeSantis doesn't like this abortion issue. He doesn't want to talk about it. He tries to slip out of it. He's very slippery. He doesn't talk to the press, but I'm just not sure that Val and Nikki can't make a run of this thing. I remain unconvinced.
Well, we will see. But he is certainly one, I think, difficult man. I think he is smarter than Trump. Trump doesn't have any ideology. I mean, Trump is just no. It's all transactional, and in that sense, DeSantis is more. You know, could be more dangerous, but he is a strange. He doesn't have any friends, James. Of course, neither does Trump.
That's what it is. He has some, and people say this. The donors say it. He's not. He's no Bill Clinton. He doesn't schmooze with the donors. You know, he's very. I think he kind of talks to his wife. I mean, that's his own business. It's not his kind of, you know, antisocial personality that bothers me. It's his undemocratic way of governing and the stupid. I mean, he wants to take, you know, money from school lunches and put it in anti-trans education. I mean, oh, come on, man. Don't these children have enough shit to deal with? I mean, God almighty, man. It's just the gratuitous cruelty of some people is just sickening. And he is a gratuitously cruel man. I think Ron DeSantis, in many ways, enjoys hurting people. And boy, if you are any, these children, the suicide rate among these children, I don't know, it's 10 times it is anybody else. If you can't have a humane attitude, you're just not much of a human being.
Yeah. Well, that's him. Yeah. All right, keep those cards, letters, emails coming in because we'd love to take your questions. We can't get to them all, but we'll try to get to those we don't get to. We can have another shot at it next week. So thank you. All right, now for the outrage of the week. James, rather than an outrage, I want to pay tribute to one of the greatest athletes and citizens we've ever known, Bill Russell, the legendary Boston Celtics. You know, the Celtics hadn't won an NBA title before Russell arrived. They then won 11 of the next 13. That's unmatchable in professional sports. Some argue, yeah, well, there were fewer teams then. But as a big man, he went up against and beat the likes of Wilt Chamberlain, Walt Bellamy, Nate Thurman, Willis Reed, all in the Hall of Fame. His coach, Red Auerbach, said, Michael Jordan may be the greatest player ever, but if you want to start a team, the first person you pick is Bill Russell. This incredibly proud and intelligent black man refused to bow to the stain of segregation and bigotry. He stood up for courage from Muhammad Ali to Colin Kaepernick. He had a reputation for being standoffish. He didn't give autographs. But let me tell you one story. At Senator Kennedy's funeral, most guests took a bus to the cathedral, including my wife, Judy Woodruff. She wasn't an NBA fan, but when we got to the church, she talked about the engaging conversation she had with her seatmate, who she didn't know. Then, as this regal 6'10" icon began walking down the aisle, she said, "That's him." Never mind the presidents and other dignitaries who were there at that service, all eyes were turned to Bill Russell. What a life.
Yeah, I don't have anything. I don't have an outrage. I agree. I endorse it. He was an incredible person. I was around him. I know him as be a little bit of a stretch, but I've had conversations with him on three or four different occasions. And I've seen the way that I reacted to him and other people reacted to him. And I'm proud to say he's a native Louisianian. And he had he was just an incredible competitor, athlete, and he was a human being that when he spoke, you listened and listened intently. So, yes, he'll be missed. What a great guy. What a great career.
One of the smartest athletes of all times. There's a story on one of these, I think it's a Bill Simmons podcast, who spent time with him, and his wife went, and they went back to a 1956 Oregon State San Francisco game. This was 50 years later. He remembered every single play. There was never a player who was a better student of the game. So, and
one of my favorite quotes is when he was playing at San Francisco and he won those national championships, Casey Jones was on the same team, and he was declared ineligible for the NCAA tournament. And Russell was in college. I said, "Well, what do you think?" He said, "The spokes change, the wheel keeps rolling."
Yeah.
What a spokes change. The wheel keeps rolling.
I think they won 56 straight games, 55 straight games. The San Francisco Dons were not a powerhouse before Bill Russell arrived.
And neither
were the Boston Celtics.
No.
Thank you for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. Don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Miracle Brand and Magic Spoon, in the show notes. We thank you for supporting them. When you do, you help make this podcast happen. To keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. Please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.